everyone. Thank you so much for tuning into Advertising Week's Great Minds, People and Culture podcast. I'm your host, Brenna Kinsey, Executive Vice President of Advertising Week and Emerald. Today's guest is Dr. Lori A. Watson, CEO of RaceWork. Dr. Lori is a trailblazer in education and racial equity. She's deeply influenced by her family's pioneering legacy in Greenville, Mississippi. With over 20 years as an educator and former equity transformation specialist at Courageous Conversation, Dr. Lori Watson focuses on advancing systemic racial equity across various sectors. In our conversation today, we'll explore effective strategies for fostering safe, open discussions about race in the workplace. We'll also discuss how organizations can navigate race and political differences, and how leadership can be better equipped to respond to racial incidents and the needs of their talent. Hello, Dr. Watson, and welcome.
Thank you. Hello. How are you this beautiful day we're having here in California?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much. And thank you for joining us. And I'm really excited for our conversation. It's definitely an important one. But before we get started, I'd love to hear in your own words why you chose to do this important work. Was it something that happened in your life that inspired you to do it? Or was it something that you always wanted to do? Is this what you wanted to be when you grew up? Tell us a little bit more about that.
You know, what you're asking me, I feel like this is the way my participants feel in my sessions when I ask them to tell me your why of this work. And, you know, it is very personal. I mean, as someone who grew up as a Black person, and not just Black person, but same gender loving person in Mississippi in the 70s and 80s, I know what it means to be someone who has experienced a lot of isms or phobias, or however you want to describe it. And later in life, when I became an educator, I began to recognize how my lived experience was quite similar. I could connect with some of the experiences that students were having that I was working with. And when the district that I was working in began to engage in this work of racial equity, I just got so consumed by it and just saw the value that it brought to the lived experiences of our students and folks of color as a whole. And I just, this was something that I really had to be a part of. And I think what keeps me so connected to this is that a lot of the work that I do does come from understanding what it's like to be in a situation where you feel marginalized, where you feel oppressed, and what is it that I can do to bring more people, the masses, those who may not have that understanding or that experience, to a place of elevated consciousness, and so that people can not just be better, but do better. And so I love this work. You know, a lot of people say it's so hard, it's so challenging. How do you do that? How do you go into these spaces? I love it. I wouldn't want to do anything other than what I do every day. And so, yeah, it's a personal thing, and it's how do I help make the world a better place, I guess I'll say. That's my small contribution to it.
I love that. And you talked about you being an educator, and I know you continue to do this work in the education space, but you're also doing this work in the workplace. Can you tell us a little bit about the services that you do and the partnership you do with workplaces and leadership on that level?
Yeah, of course. You know, the work isn't that different. The foundational pieces, once we get to a more advanced level, we start to separate a little bit. But the work is just basically, how do we have conversations about race? And how do I teach people tools to recognize that it's okay to engage in this conversation. So many people historically have been conditioned to believe that if I talk about race, then I'm being racist. Or if I talk about race, that makes me a bad person or something of the sort. But this is just about how do we see each other? You know, how do we recognize that based on our skin color, our facial features, our hair texture, the shape of our eyes, all those things that make up race, so to speak, in this world, afford us different lived experiences in this society. And so if we want to create spaces where everyone, you know, is treated as a full human, and we know that right now everyone doesn't have that experience, if we want to be able to empathize, if we want to be able to meet people where they are and more deeply understand their experiences, then we got to have that conversation about this topic. And it's not what a lot of people believe, that, you know, if we talk about race, then I'm going to feel bad, I'm going to be made to feel guilty, or I'm going to be under attack. It's none of that. Just how do I expand my racial consciousness? How do I use these tools to have these conversations? How do we begin in our organizations to recognize where everyone is not having, you know, the most positive experience, or the playing field isn't level for everyone? And so in organizations, it's the exact same thing again that we're doing in education, except, you know, we might start to look at curriculum and how we engage with children in classrooms. But basically, when you're looking at organizations, how are we engaging with employees? How are we looking at our policies and practices that are in place? Does it meet the needs of everybody? And so that's really what it's all about. You know, I tell people my kind of, I guess I'll say is my tagline for my company, Racework, is, you know, racework is love work. You know, how do we open our hearts up to just seeing people? And it's soul work. How do I get more conscious about my beliefs, ways in which I've been socialized and conditioned to believe about people, even without even recognizing that? These implicit biases that we all have, how do I start to surface and examine those? And then finally, I always want to make sure people understand that race work is humanity work. Because when we hold on to, you know, some of these irrational fears and illogical beliefs about who people are, that requires us to dehumanize them. And so this means if I'm in that place of consciousness and knowing, then I'm seeing people for, you know, being on this equal footing of just being a human the same as I am. And that's what my focus is on bringing to organizations.
And do you think that the younger generation is doing a better job of talking about race than previous generations?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I have a student program that's called SLAM, Student Leaders for an Anti-Racist Movement. And I work with middle and high school students. And these children far outpace adults when it comes to this conversation. I mean, they're so open to just seeing people for who they are. What I recognize is that when children are challenged, it's because of the adults that have gotten in the way. But if you just leave them to, you know, be who they are, kids just want to connect with everybody. They're so open to, you know, when it comes to race and religion and gender and sexual orientation. I mean, it's so different. I think back, as I mentioned in the beginning, you know, 30, 40 years ago when I was in school, and the secret that you had to keep, and particularly from adults. But these kids, I mean, middle school, oh, I'm transgender, or I'm non-binary, or this is my girlfriend, or whatever it is, there's no judgment. And so I do believe that, you know, part of what we need to do is we got to start looking to these younger generations, because they don't, or they aren't holding on to these, you know, historical ways of being that constantly judge and separate us from each other. But it is more about bringing us together. So yeah, I'm all about this next generation.
Wonderful. And in the context of work, what are some critical strategies for creating a workplace environment where employees truly feel safe discussing race and how it might impact their work and, of course, their lives outside of work?
Right. Well, you know, when I do this work, it all starts with the personal. And so I often tell people, we're going to go on a personal journey. You're going to go on a personal journey of, you know, awakening, whether you've been engaged in these conversations or not. I believe that there is some shifting that will occur as we have these conversations. And so I think it's just so important that people have that willingness to, you know, do this differently than the way that it's been done before, or, you know, it really hasn't been done before for a lot of folks. And so I think part of it personally is, you know, doing your own work, thinking about the, how does race show up in my own life? You know, what are my beliefs? How have I been conditioned and socialized to think about race? And so that's part of that personal work, you know. And when it comes to that collective work in a workplace environment, you know, it is still each individual doing their work. But what I also have to remind people of is that in a workplace, you know, although we might show up as individuals, it requires it's a collective environment, and it requires us to come together interdependently. And so for us to be able to have this conversation, or some of the strategies that I use are, we first got to start with a common language. People show up with all these different meanings and ideas around, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion, you know, what everyone's talking about right now, but even race. You know, people show up with all these different ways of understanding it. And so how do we level that playing field by creating a common language for what it is that we mean when we say race, or what it is that we mean when we say certain terms? And I think it's just important that in the organization, there is a clear vision and mission for the work. What are our values that we want to uphold? You know, because it's so important that we keep those at the core of how we operate in this space. And making sure that people recognize that as we lean into the work of anti-racism, this is not anti anyone. And again, that's a narrative that is out there, that this is, you know, anti-white people in particular. But again, it's not that. And so when I mentioned before that this is love work, it's not the hate work that so many people have alluded to. And that just makes me think of the quote by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and I might butcher it a little bit, but it's something around, to those who are privileged, equality looks like oppression. And so if our society has been constructed in a way where those in the dominant race, you know, those who are in the dominant culture have never had to share space, and now I have to, then for a lot of folks, there comes with that a belief that something's being taken away from me and now I'm oppressed. But what I try to get people to understand, and again, this goes back to those values that we uphold and our core mission and our common language, what this work is really about is, how do we just work to create a space where everyone thrives. And so it's about having those conversations with a set of tools that I teach people to support that. And it requires people to really have to learn those and put those into practice, and realizing that we're going to make mistakes along the way. We're going to mess up. And at the same time, how do we give grace to those who do mess up when they do? But it's just that constant learning journey along the way.
You mentioned defining common values and what the goal is and what we're trying to achieve with our D&I work, you know, obviously specific to each company. In your experience and in the work that you've done with your clients, who is it that determines what those values are? Is that the C-suite? Is that a combination of the C-suite with the employees? Like, who comes up with those values?
You know, I believe that everyone plays a role in establishing those values. When companies first start, I know a lot of things come from the CEO, the C-suite. And they say, hey, this is who we are and this is what we're about. And I think there comes a time when we have to reassess, you know, and bring in more voices to the table. How does this represent all of us, that this is what we want to hold at the core? Because if I'm showing up, I might think that this value is very important, but it's a complete disconnect from employees that I have in the organization. And so I think it's important at some point that we're always coming back and revisiting those. And it doesn't mean that we're necessarily, you know, doing a complete shift, but how do we start to bring on board some of those values that represent all of us and not just some of us?
I love that. Thanks for clarifying that. Obviously, we're in an election year, race is inevitably a part of political conversations and political differences. How should organizations approach conversations about race and political differences without alienating any group or individual?
Yeah, I've been working with some folks really trying to prepare for what's gonna occur between, you know, now and November and beyond, because I think either way it goes, there's still gonna be a lot of conversation going on. And what I always try to share with people is that, you know, the bottom line is we're all entitled to our perspectives, you know, and I think, again, it goes back to this place of people trying to create this polarization, you know, of you're Republican, you're Democrat, and I know who you are because of that and everything. And where we have to get to and recognize is that we can show up from these different places, yet still be respectful of each other. You know, conversations don't have to be this competition that it has become. You know, you see so many people now and it blows up because it has to be this idea of I'm right, you're wrong. You know, I'm good, you're bad. But the tools that I teach people really create a space where, you know, I have to be okay with sharing my perspective, but I also have to be able to lean in and listen to your perspective as well, you know, and recognizing that the conversation may be uncomfortable, and that's okay. When we're trying to do things differently or, you know, grow, it does become uncomfortable. And so we have to get to a place where we are comfortable being uncomfortable. And one of the tools that I teach, which is the intersection, helps me to recognize how am I showing up in this conversation? And what it does is teach, you know, I say there are, and this is borrowed from some of Carl Jung's work, you know, I might show up in a place of heart, which is this emotional place. You know, I had to recognize this is where I am, analyze what that emotion is. I might show up in spirit, which is that place of really being, you know, tied to my beliefs, my morals, my values. I might be in my mind. What am I thinking? What am I seeking to understand right now? Or perhaps I might be in my body, that place of wanting to act and do something. And so my work with using this intersection is recognizing where I am, analyzing what's happening for me there, and then attempting to get myself to a place of what I refer to as being equalized. How do I try and get myself centered or balanced? Because that's when I'm my most powerful self. If I'm so emotional in this conversation, I'm probably going to say or do something that is not going to be so great, or it's going to go off the rails. But if I can recognize this is what's happening for me right now, you know, and I can also, you know, recognize where you are, and I can get myself equalized, and perhaps I can meet you where you are. And now we can have this conversation where I can say what it is that I need to say respectfully. You know, I can also lean in to listen and learn from you, or maybe even unlearn some things. And if it's uncomfortable, that's okay. Because again, the key word being respect, because, and I love quotes. It just makes me think about Baldwin's quote where he said, you know, and again, I'm probably going to butcher some of it, but it's something to the effect of we can disagree and still love each other, unless your disagreement is rooted in my oppression and denial of my right to exist, or something to that effect. And so I think what organizations have to do is, you know, how do we create that culture where, yes, we can have some, you know, discourse, but we have to do it in a respectful way and recognizing these core values that we hold at the center as we do this.
And you spoke about a little bit before about the fact that we, you know, companies and people doing the work and people who are building self-awareness and working on themselves and how they show up to the world, and whether it's in the workplace or outside of the workplace, you are going to make some mistakes. But I find that most companies are so afraid to make a mistake that they're not even taking action. And because sometimes those mistakes, you know, result in backlash from employees or few people who are not happy with the messaging or your action, they just don't do anything. They stay neutral. What is your advice to those companies who are not doing anything because they don't want to make a mistake or offend people?
Yeah. I think it's a mistake. We can't ignore when these different incidents or situations occur. I mean, right then and there, what we're doing is marginalizing people who are marginalized even more. And so, you know, what kind of spaces are we creating in those situations? I think it's important that the organization make some kind of communication. Again, you know, as an organization, we stand against this, or we stand for, you know, yada, yada, yada. And we want to do what's necessary to support our employees who have been impacted, and not just in a performative way, but what else are we doing to address that situation? I think sometimes we forget that there are people in organizations who are so personally being impacted by things that are happening, you know, inside the organization as well as, you know, outside of the organization. And so what I would suggest is that we are more proactive than reactive. Sometimes people want to address things and, you know, they're running around. What do we do? This just occurred. But what have we done before that to create a space so that we know how we're going to move in certain situations, and how have we created a space where our employees already feel a sense of support and safety, whether that be, you know, ERG groups that organizations have, whether there are, you know, counseling sessions that are established, whether it's even just being in a place of consciousness and recognizing that something that might have occurred. Sometimes my employees of color need to just take a beat. And so how am I not showing up, you know, saying this needs to be done, that needs to be done, when this person is dealing with the reality of what just occurred to someone who might have a similar story to them? And it's also not going to those people of color and expecting them to tell the organization what to do in this moment. And again, when I talk about this proactive stance, it's because we don't want to just show up in those moments, you know, and oftentimes I think about 4 years ago, you know, when the whole world was on fire with the pandemic. And then to add to that, the situation with the murder of George Floyd, and you got all these organizations that are, you know, we got to do something. We got to put out a DEI statement. We want to create this and create that. And yes, and where are organizations now? And where are organizations every day? What about the days before George Floyd? What about the days after George Floyd? What just occurs that makes the headline in the news, or the headlines in the news, isn't what's impacting our marginalized employees the most? It's the day in, the day out microaggressions. It's the day in and day out ways in which they've been overlooked. It's all of those things that, you know, need to be created in organizations so that when something happens, people aren't running around trying to fix things, because it can't be fixed in one effort. You know, we're talking about adaptive work here. And so it's about how do we create a culture where, you know, if those things happen, we are better equipped or better prepared to address that. Does that make sense?
100%, absolutely. Of course, the question then is, how can an organization start that work, and what metrics or indicators can an organization use to measure the equity initiatives, essentially, and how often should they be assessed? Like, how do we measure the readiness, the preparedness for those big events, so that our employees are already feeling good, so that when those big events happen, it's not like we're just trying to create something in a vacuum, right, but they're then in supported spaces?
You know, it's definitely important to, you got to assess the organization in a way of, you know, both qualitatively as well as quantitatively. So many companies or organizations think, you know, I just got to have that, those numbers, that data. But oftentimes when it comes to creating an anti-racist culture, that's not going to hit everything that you need. You got to set up some ways that you can access that qualitative data. What is your experience in this organization? And so I definitely see, you know, those personal narratives as being key to assessing that. But I also think, you know, that it's about what are the policies and practices that we have in place that we can look at as far as, you know, looking at our numbers. Who is here? How do we break that down demographically by race or culture or gender or whatever it is that we want to measure? What does the C-suite look like? And in most places, the C-suite is largely white. And, you know, there's a lack of consciousness of recognizing that something's wrong with that. Because this is what's been normalized. That's who's always been in power. That's who's always been in that place, in that space. And so how do we start to, you know, bring in multiple perspectives to notice that? But again, it's looking at hiring, looking at who's leaving the organization. What are some of those exit surveys show? How do we look at, you know, the pathways to leadership? Maybe it's not diverse right now, but what are some of the pathways that are created and who's doing well in those? Looking at the pay gaps, I think all of those are important ways that we start to measure in a more quantitative way that people, that some people need in order to say, okay, you know, this is necessary. And just reading so many articles and resources that say the more diverse an organization is, you know, the bottom line is better. And so for those that are for profit, when you're bringing in these multiple perspectives and different ways of doing things, you're a more profitable organization. And so I think all of those are some of the ways to really be able to measure it that might meet the needs of folks that that qualitative doesn't do it for them, but that still, I think that is a huge piece of it to be able to have, again, if it's a survey or focus groups or bringing in someone to be able to capture something. Sometimes it takes that. I've done affinity groups for different organizations, and because there are going to be some people that are going to share things in an affinity group that they won't share in a multiracial group. And so all of those are, if you're really trying to get to the truth or really want to understand your organization, you got to figure out what are those ways that are going to surface more truth than not. And honestly, there may be some organizations that really don't want to access that truth because we're great. We're doing all the things the way they ought to be done. But it still misses out on those, the counter narrative, I'll say.
And for organizations that do want to do the work, but let's say they get the data, how do you help them figure out what to address first? Because the data could be overwhelming, right? And then, you know, depending on the resources you have internally, you're like, well, where do I even start? How do you help your clients usually prioritize what to tackle first so that it's, you know, long-term and obviously sustainable and scalable?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I usually go through a process with folks of, you know, what is it that we want to work on now? What is it that we can kind of do more in the long term, and we'll put it into some different boxes and really have that conversation round and round, and recognizing that some of the things that come up are quick fix technical solutions that we can put into place right now. There might be some things that, hey, we can write this policy or change this process in how we do things, and boom, it's done. And looking at some of those things that are more long-term, what I like to do is sit with people sometimes. Some organizations have, you know, of course, everybody has a strategic plan. But what happens is you'll have a strategic plan that completely misses out on those equity pieces or those questions about centering, you know, how do we lean into DEI? And it's completely dismissive of that. And what I have people do or look at creating is an equity plan. And so that way, as we prioritize things, we're creating some concrete goals and really trying to keep people accountable. So now, you know, there is a plan in place where it's not just saying we've got to do this, but this is what it looks like. And so I think it's just important, again, you know, because the last organization that I worked with when we were talking about creating, well, first we identified some of the equity gaps, and what we did, we ran that was from an equity team in the organization. So people all across the organization, different levels of the organization, and identifying some gaps, getting feedback from people that they work with. And then I wanted them to prioritize. And then I went to leadership and we had a conversation around prioritizing some of these. Some of them lined up, some of them didn't. But then it became, all right, so how do we continue to have this conversation in recognizing why we believe that some of this are things that maybe we do in year one and then maybe this in year two. And so it's just, again, what you named in the first place, prioritizing it, setting a plan, creating those goals. How are we holding people accountable to them?
Yeah. I'm glad you set different timelines as an example, year one, year two. In your experience, how long does it take to see an actual cultural shift?
Yeah.
From the time you gather the information to prioritizing and actually doing the work, what does that time frame look like? Is it 2 years? Is it 3 years? Is it 6 months? Could it be immediate?
My ask when I work with people is always at least a minimum of 3 years. And you might start to get some traction by then. But it goes beyond. I mean, it's ongoing. It's ongoing. It's never ending. I always say, you know, because racism is so sophisticated, you know, every time you think you recognize this is how we need to do this, it shifts on you and shows up in a completely different way. So it is the ongoing, you know, learning. It's the looking at the plan. Let's come back to the table, you know, and reassess it. It's a cycle of inquiry. It's just the ongoing, overlapping way in which we, you know, I call my process learning, articulating, and working. And so it's a playoff of my initials, LAW. But I thought I would throw my initials in there some kind of way.
At least you won't forget it, right?
And so, you know, in that learning phase, it's all about, you know, how do we develop, again, this common language, the understanding, the tools, expanding my own personal consciousness around, you know, anti-racism and racial equity. How do I start to recognize the ways in which I believe things? And so part of that is my personal work in that learning phase, and it becomes, what are we starting to learn about the organization? As we continue in that next phase of articulating, now it's really starting to see the organization through, you know, a lens of more heightened consciousness. And so how do what it is that I'm still learning, because it's not a linear progression, it's overlapping. How do I start to implement some of what I'm doing and what I know and understand better and merge that into my professional practices? So I'm merging, you know, with increased confidence, anti-racism into what it is that I do every day as, again, I'm surfacing, I'm examining the organization ongoing. This is what we do well now. This is where we still have gaps. This is where, you know, we need to prioritize this or prioritize that. And again, we start to work on creating that plan for anti-racism or that equity plan. And all of this is still developing personally and collectively, this willingness to do the work, the skill to do the work, building capacity for the organization to be an anti-racist organization and continuing to expand my knowledge. And then my third phase, the working is, you know, now we're putting things into practice and we're continuing to reflect and connect, reflect on what it is that we've done, connect what it is that we've done, where we are and where we're trying to go, and then actually effecting, putting things into play. And there's a feedback loop in that. And so again, that's the coming back to assess. And as I mentioned, you know, a minimum of 3 years, and that's not gonna get people to the place that sometimes people want to be. There are so many folks who think that, okay, we do this and now we're good. You know, we had that training. We got this. We read that book. We're good to go. But it's the constant work. And so now, maybe by the time we get to that third phase, I back off a little bit, but you still need, how are we checking in? How are we still, you know, continuing to lean into the work? And so I will always tell people, and I know you've heard it time and time again, it is not a sprint. It is definitely a marathon. And one of my principles is we have to resist relying on a rapid resolution, because and that ties to my first principle, which is a commitment to the cause. You got to stay commitment. It can't be one and done. You know, that didn't work, and now we're going over here and trying something else, or we're going over there and doing something else. No, you got to stay with the process and continue to roll with it.
You talk a lot about self-awareness, and most of what you discuss is about free will. It's about, you know, observing yourself, bringing yourself to the table, reading, getting educated. How about those who don't feel inspired to do the work to be an anti-racist?
Yeah.
How do you get them on board?
Yeah, it's challenging. And what I always try to work toward is, how do we create a what's my word that I want to use? Not the guiding coalition, but I'm always hoping you get more people on the train that want to move forward than not. Because I believe if you have more folks that are all about this and your culture starts to shift, I'm always hopeful that that's going to somehow influence other people in a way that, if we're all practicing it this way, if these are our policies and our processes and we're holding people accountable, then while it may not show up in your beliefs, that it has to still manifest in your behaviors, because this is who we are as an organization. Because we're not gonna, everybody's beliefs aren't gonna be the same. Everybody may not have this, as you said, this intrinsic desire to be an anti-racist. And I get that. But what are those behaviors that are showing up, and how are they impacting the organization? Because it just goes back to systems thinking, how beliefs drive behaviors that yield the results. But if we can't, if you don't have a belief that, you know, we should consciously, intentionally, and deliberately disrupt racism, we still got to create the culture where your behaviors aren't resulting in hurt and harm for others.
I love that framing. Thank you so much. And as we wrap up, how can people find you and how can people engage with you to help them do this type of work?
Oh, yeah. I can be found at race-work.com. That's my website. on there. You can contact me. You can get access to some of my programming. I'm in the process of updating some of it because, you know, I don't work in the month of July. I have to have a month off to rest and rejuvenate. Yeah. And during that time, new things come in my head where I'm supposed to be resting. I can't because I'm always thinking of what's another way to approach this. How can I, you know, impact people in a deeper way or whatever? And so different ideas come up. And so again, I'm working on updating some of those, but definitely check out my website and you can reach out to me and we can see how hopefully a partnership between RaceWork and your company, you know, could really create that space again for anti-racism. That's what we all want, an anti-racist culture. You know, again, I always just describe it simply, consciously, intentionally, and deliberately disrupting racism.
Thank you so much, Dr. Watson.
Thank you.